Support for this public radio podcast comes from Thrivent Financial, a not-for-profit Fortune 500 company helping members thrive in retirement. You can learn more at thriventfinancial.com/retirement.
Hi, I'm Tess Vigeland. Think kids don't care about personal finance? Think again.
It's the Gen Y, it's the MySpace generation, if you will, who is frequenting these sites. We've seen many of them crop up really just in the last 12 months or so.
That's Emmett Higdon with this week's Marketplace Money Inside Quote. He says young people are flocking to websites with a certain financial bent. So, what do these sites do? Are they A, sites like Zillow that tell you what homes are worth? Kids use them to decide where to move after college. Or do the sites B, let them get money advice from other users, a la Facebook? Or are we talking about sites that C, let them scramble the speeches of the Fed's Ben Bernanke to comic effect? It's all the rage with new MBA grads. Only one answer is true, of course. Find out which one on this week's Marketplace Money from American Public Media. From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, this is Marketplace Money. It's not easy being green, especially if you're an investor. How do you know which companies are really changing color and which are just changing light bulbs? I'm Tess Vigeland. This is Marketplace Money from American Public Media.
Marketplace Money is supported by Thrivent Financial for Lutherans, a not-for-profit Fortune 500 company helping members thrive in retirement. You can learn more at thrivent.com/retirement.
I don't know about you, but I paid $3.35 at the pump this week. And there's talk we could hit $4 a gallon as early as this spring. Meanwhile, the U.S. House approved $18 billion worth of new taxes on big oil companies, with that money slated to go toward tax breaks for alternative energy sources. The president has said he'll veto it if it gets to his desk. A lot of folks are trying to do their part with so-called green investing. Just a couple of years ago, eco-friendly funds were virtually non-existent. Now there are more than 24. But as Sarah Gardner reports from the Marketplace Sustainability Desk, these investments come in different shades of green.
Cliff Feigenbaum was green before green was cool. He founded the Green Money Journal in 1992, so now he's reveling in eco-investing's new status.
And to have Fortune magazine last spring say that green is good, we weren't sure that would ever happen.
But Feigenbaum warns funds use different environmental screens and criteria when picking their investments, so for purists, some funds may not be green enough. Aaron Gray heads up marketing for Green Century Capital Management. The firm's Green Century Equity Fund includes household names like Procter & Gamble, Microsoft, and Johnson & Johnson.
Johnson & Johnson is a great example. They are one of the largest corporate purchasers of alternative energy.
Gray says that Johnson & Johnson may not be perfect, but it's headed in the right environmental direction. Green Century also screens companies for things like recycling, toxic emissions, and energy use. Other green funds focus strictly on companies selling solutions to climate change. Calvert's new Global Alternative Energy Fund invests in wind and solar companies, among others. But this green fund also includes companies that own nuclear plants. Calvert's Paul Hilton says that's been controversial. But he says many utilities on the leading edge of solar and wind, like Florida Power and Light, sell nuclear power, too.
So what we did is we said this, if a company really is a leader for alternative energy and is doing the right things, we will still allow a company to have a legacy plant as long as there are no plans to build future nuclear power plants.
Hilton and others in this field say investors who want to do right by the planet can hire a financial advisor to help them, or they can do their own homework, read the fund's annual reports, their websites, and dig around the internet, they say. Websites like cleanedge.com or socialinvest.org can help, and they warn that often the narrower the fund, the more risk involved.
There's always market corrections, especially if people get too giddy about any particular sector, and that could happen in alternative energy.
That's Julie Gordy, a VP at Pax World Management. She says some analysts liken all the hoopla around renewable energy to the internet bubble of the 90s. She also reminds investors that not all green funds use traditional social screens like labor conditions or fair wages. So if you care about the who, where, and how of those solar panels you're invested in, you'll need to do more legwork. I'm Sarah Gardner for Marketplace Money.
And we've got links to those funds that Sarah mentioned at marketplace.org.
Marketplace Money is supported by Thrivent Financial for Lutherans, working to provide tools and expertise to help you meet your retirement goals and ultimately thrive in retirement. Let's thrive on the web at thrivent.com/retirement and by FINRA Investor Education Foundation, helping inform today's investor through innovative grant making and educational funding. Online at finrafoundation.org.
Call it Facebook Finance. Some of the young'uns out there, I guess I'm not one of them anymore, now use a single website to track credit card statements, bills, and online bank accounts. But there's more! You can chat with other users about financial goals, as well as the rad new indie band. Do they still say rad these days? Venture capitalists have been busy investing millions of dollars in personal finance sites like SpendView, Buxfer, Mint, and Wasabi. For details, we're joined by Emmett Higdon of Forrester Research. Welcome.
Thank you so much for having me.
Tell me a little bit about these sites. What makes them different from, say, sites that we've known before where you can have your bank account and your credit card accounts there all together for you?
From a perspective of what you can do with these sites, relatively little difference, actually. The difference largely has been the difference in the user base. It's the Gen Y. It's the MySpace generation, if you will, who is frequenting these sites. We've seen many of them crop up really just in the last 12 months or so.
I think this is fairly unusual for young people to actually be paying attention to their finances.
It sure is. And what attracts them to these sites initially is the similar kinds of features that you see on the social networking sites like a Facebook or MySpace.
So what, like you can chat with other users about why you're in $50,000 credit card debt?
Absolutely. Many of these users know very little about personal finance or what to do about the debts that they've accumulated. And these sites are starting to help them figure that out by showing them what others in similar situations have done to get out of the debt that they're in.
Well, have you looked at the sites and is the advice that is given to those questions valid?
Well, I often joke that you get what you pay for when it comes to these
and
sites.
And these sites are free, right?
These sites are all free, exactly. The advice largely comes from the other users on these sites. So there is no professional advice being dispensed by the folks who run the site themselves. In large measure, the advice that users are getting are coming from their peers or coming from the other users. So in many cases, that's very good. If someone has had a lot of college debt, for example, and knows what they can do to solve that problem, that can be very good advice. The other piece that folks are coming to this site for are tools, simple tools to help them set up a budget, manage their money, and in many cases, simply learn where is that money going.
So how exactly do those work? Is it like a Quicken online?
It's very similar to what a lot of the banks have done with the firms that we call the aggregation firms. And these are the Yodlee.coms of the world who provide those links into all of your different companies. This is what gives your bank the ability to say, come to our site, give us all of the names of the other companies you deal with, and we'll give you a single page that lists all of your accounts all in one place, whether that's your credit card account or your bank account or even some of your other bills. They'll put them all on one page for you. So these sites are very similar in that they will aggregate all of your other bills, all of your other bank accounts in one place.
But all of that information is there for a hacker to go in and get it all in one fell swoop.
It absolutely is. And certainly it's something that the banks wrestle with all of the time in terms of the security around their online banking sites. Taking Yodlee as an example, Yodlee has been around and has been working with the banks for many, many years to offer this functionality where you can see all of your accounts in one place. And they've done a very good job of assuring users and giving them a comfort level that, hey, your passwords, your IDs are going to be safe. With these new sites that have come online, the Mints, the Buxfers, the Expensers of the world, how comfortable will these users be with giving up their credentials to a third-party website that just popped up last month? It is safe. It is secure. The real question is, will all of these other sites that you're going to and giving your credentials to, where will they be in 3 months, in 6 months' time?
Do you or would you use any of these services?
I plan to, absolutely, for one very good reason. The major banks, unfortunately, have been very slow to pick up on this functionality. And I think that this is really a wake-up call for them. These sites, if you take the top 6 or 7 sites, they've got about 400,000 users in total going to these sites today. That's a lot of customers.
Emmett Higdon is a senior analyst at Forrester Research. Thanks for your time.
Thank you so much.
This is Marketplace Money from American Public Media. Our economics editor, Chris Farrell, is here for the audio op-ed we call The Straight Story. And Chris, I've got a challenge for you.
All right.
Well, you know, often on this show, you sing the praises of Treasury Inflation Protected Securities, TIPS. You said it last week in this very segment. But there's a recent Wall Street Journal column that argues, yes, inflation is a big risk, but, quote, inflation-protected bonds are an even bigger risk these days.
Well, Tess, the column's right about one thing. There's been a bidding frenzy for inflation protection, and that has pushed up the price of TIPS and drop their yield, and that's not a good deal.
Mm-hmm.
But that's not the same thing as saying TIPS are a bad investment. Here's the straight story. Inflation is the enemy of long-term savers, and TIPS remain a vital weapon in the anti-inflation armory of the individual investor.
Well, Chris, why the frenzy to own these things right now?
Well, Tess, the producer price index is running over the past 3 months at a 7.4% rate.
And that's inflation at the wholesale level.
At the wholesale level. Now we go to the consumer price index. So you're wandering down the grocery store and you're, you know, pulling off toothpaste or you're buying some food. Headline consumer price inflation's running at a 6.8% rate.
Ouch.
Over the past 3 months. And that tells you why there is this flood of money that is going into Treasury inflation protected securities. So there is always a timing issue. The timing is not great to be pouring money into TIPS, but the fundamental instinct is correct. TIPS are one way to protect your portfolio against inflation.
Well, let's talk a little more about this column in the Wall Street Journal from columnist Brett Ahrens.
Sure.
You know, he says that a lot of investors own TIPS in taxable accounts, and you have actually urged people not to do that, to put them in retirement funds instead. If they are in these taxable accounts, in his words, that can end up being a long-term disaster. What do you think?
Well, that's where I think he was sort of stacking the deck, because I'm skeptical that a lot of individual investors own them in taxable accounts for this very simple reason. Let's say you buy a 10-year TIP. When it matures, you know, you get all your inflation-adjusted money, but you're not getting your inflation-adjusted money year after year. But guess what? Uncle Sam says, we're going to tax you as if you were getting that money year after year.
Uh-oh.
And that's why I always recommend that you put these into a retirement account, because you don't pay taxes on a retirement account until you pull the money out. And I think for most investors, these are in retirement plans. And so, yes, he's right, but I think he's kind of stacking his deck there.
All right. So would you buy TIPS now?
As part of a regular buying program, yes, I would continue to buy TIPS, but I'd also be looking at I-bonds.
Give us a little bit of a primer on what the difference is.
What an I-bond is, this is a savings bond. You buy it from the Treasury, compounds, tax deferred, and then when you sell it, then you pay your taxes. So you don't have to worry about this tax issue with I-bonds. And by the way, I have to throw out my third one, cash. Cash is a great hedge against inflation. So between I-bonds, TIPS, in cash, you can build a portfolio that is preserved against the ravages of inflation.
All right. The Straight Story with our economics editor, Chris Farrell. And Chris, we'll check back with you later in the show for a little getting personal.
Thanks a lot, Tess.
Just ahead, how's this for workplace safety?
Some of the risks are death, getting eaten by a polar bear, getting hypothermia, getting crushed by ice.
Sign me up. The day in the work life of an Arctic explorer. It's coming up on Marketplace Money from American Public Media. This is Marketplace Money from American Public Media. I'm Tess Viglund. This weekend on the shores of the Dead Sea, the Kingdom of Jordan is hosting an economic forum to drum up new business opportunities. If you want to do business in the region, get a job there maybe, it might help to learn Arabic. Marketplace's Jennifer Collins dropped in on a language class here in Los Angeles.
If you want to take Arabic, you're in for a challenge. These students at the Levantine Cultural Center are learning exactly that.
Or? Perfume?
Welcome to Conversational Arabic 101, where things rarely get easier. even with practice. American students sink millions of dollars into Arabic classes each year. Many say they're taking the language as a way of dabbling in Middle Eastern history and culture. Others, like Herzl Tobi, study with purpose.
How do you say remember?
Tobi is an actor. This summer, he'll appear as an Israeli military commander in an Adam Sandler comedy. He's got dark hair and eyes, perfect to play Middle Eastern characters. For many of his roles, Arabic is essential.
That's my casting. That's my typecast, Arabic. And so if they need an Arabic-speaking actor who also knows how to ride a horse, then, you know.
Giddy up! Tobi first learned about his lucrative looks from a rather unpolitically correct drama teacher.
He just suddenly said to me, "Get ready for it. You're going to play terrorist for the rest of your life."
And Toby's not alone. Roles for Middle Easterners have increased at least fivefold in the past 7 years. And they pay, too. Even low-level speaking parts bring in about $500 a day. Toby's had a steady stream of them, so much so that he quit his day job a year ago. His latest gig is a horror movie. He plays, wait for it, a terrorist. This is just one of his lines.
"Excuse me, but where are we going to get such nuclear material?"
Actors aren't the only ones on a quest to learn Arabic. Kirk Belknap of the National Middle East Language Resource Center says about 24,000 college students took Arabic classes last year. That's five times more students than a decade ago.
One of the major problems with this growth has been that we've had a very, very significant challenge in placing trained people in classrooms. Well-trained Arabic teachers are really a hot item right now.
He says Arabic teachers can command higher salaries than professors of other languages. Yet very few people speak the language well enough to teach. Despite the thousands who enroll in beginning Arabic, U.S. academia ekes out only about 40 to 50 fluent speakers a year. And when it comes to business professionals, forget about it.
MBA programs are notorious for being impatient about what their students are doing with their time. So you're not going to sink a bunch of time into language study while you're in your MBA programs.
So some students discover Arabic later in their careers, like media consultant Josh Elbaum. He's been traveling to the Middle East for 12 years, and he says every one of his clients speaks English. He didn't need to learn Arabic. That is until one night after work, Elbaum went out to a restaurant in Jeddah or Beirut. He can't remember which town. He was seated at a table of 10 Arabic speakers, and out of hospitality, every one of them switched to English.
And some of them speak it fluently and some of them struggle with it. But it was that moment when I realized that it was not necessarily selfish, but it wasn't very practical to expect a whole table full of people to converse in a language that's not their native language in their own country for my benefit.
After 6 months in classes, he's already noticed business in the Middle East has gotten that much easier.
There is a look, a smile, a gleam in that person's eye when, as a non-Arab, you start speaking a language which they know is not very well spoken by non-Arabs.
Elbaum only wishes he started studying Arabic sooner. He says if someone applies for a position like his and they speak Arabic, they almost automatically become a finalist for the job. I'm Jennifer Collins for Marketplace Money.
And be sure to tune in next week for an exploration of how our personal finances are connected to the Middle East. It's part of a Marketplace-wide two-week special series called The Middle East at Work. Starting next week, 130 million of you will get a letter from the IRS. Don't worry. It's just Uncle Sam writing with a simple reminder. Fill out a 2007 tax return if you want to get that rebate check. Now, normally, mail from the taxman might induce panic. Say, an audit letter that orders you to dredge up all your receipts and tax records for the past 7 years. Might be time for a little help from a tax preparer. But what if your CPA got you into that mess in the first place? You're still the one who gets in trouble. So we brought in Frank Deegan to find out how you can make sure your preparer isn't preparing you for an audit. Welcome back to the program.
Thank you, Tess. It's nice to be back.
How can you tell if your tax preparer has made a mistake. Is it possible?
It's tough. The problem is that most taxpayers rely on their preparer to prepare an accurate return.
Right.
So unless you're really going through it, it's very difficult to ascertain.
So should you go back and, at the very least, I suppose, double-check all the math?
I don't think so, because most preparers now use computer software, and it would be very rare indeed to have an arithmetic error. I think there's a couple of areas, though, maybe three areas, that taxpayers should either ask questions of the preparer or perhaps make sure that the preparer is asking questions of them.
Okay. What would those be?
Well, the first one would be contributions. Let me just give you a scenario of a prior year.
Okay.
The taxpayer may say, well, I gave $10 a week to church and $50 at Christmas and $100 to other charities. The preparer could rely on the taxpayer's oral testimony, so they would probably write down the $670, which is the total there. But now the preparer must, or at least should, turn around and now ask some questions. Do you have receipts for all those? Because Congress enacted legislation that says, regardless of the amount, you must have a receipt or a statement from the charity verifying the contribution.
All right. What else? You said there were three.
A second one, and this is probably the most shortcut areas for tax preparers, is in mortgage interest. Many preparers don't ask sufficient questions in this area. Let me give you an example once again. Taxpayer, let's say, brings into a new tax preparer a 1098 mortgage statement from the bank. And the mortgage statement says the taxpayer paid $15,000 in interest, in mortgage interest.
Mm-hmm.
If the preparer simply writes the $15,000 down, they're not doing their job.
Right.
Because some of it may not be deductible at all. It's perhaps all of it is deductible for the regular tax, but maybe only some of it is deductible for the dreaded alternative minimum tax.
Uh-oh, you had to bring that one up.
I know. Rub salt into the wounds, you know?
Okay, so make sure your tax preparer is asking you about charitable contributions and specific questions about your mortgage interest deduction. And what's number three?
And the third one test that might be of concern is a state income tax refund. Now, I realize all your listeners don't pay state income taxes because there are about nine states that don't have that. But as a general rule, one thing that if you get a state tax refund from a prior year, it may be taxable the following year. It's a little complicated, but ask your preparer if this is taxable, and if so, how much of it is taxable.
Frank Deegan is an enrolled agent, which means he is licensed by the Treasury Department to represent taxpayers before the IRS, which means, of course, that we hope we never, ever have to hire him. Thanks so much for your time, Frank.
Anytime.
Marketplace Money is supported by Thrivent Financial for Lutherans, working to provide tools and expertise to help you meet your retirement goals and ultimately thrive in retirement. Let's thrive on the web at thrivent.com/retirement. Sustainability coverage is supported in part by the Candida Sustainability Fund of the Tides Foundation, furthering values that contribute to a healthy planet.
It's time once again for Getting Personal. That's when we answer your money questions. And with me, as always, is our economics editor, Chris Farrell. Hello again, Chris.
How you doing, Tess?
All right. So let's hit the phones. And our first caller is Jason from Minneapolis. Hi, Jason.
Hi.
What do you do there in Minneapolis?
I am a college professor in the humanities.
Oh, what do you teach?
I teach Chinese literature and film.
Do you find that these days, with all the hullabaloo over China, that your classes are even more popular than ever?
They're pretty popular, but that doesn't necessarily translate into high salaries.
Guess you're still waiting for tenure, huh?
Right.
Well, what's your question for Chris today?
Well, I've only been in the profession about 4 years, though I'm 41 years old.
Mm-hmm.
And most of my savings is in a voluntary retirement account and then in a required retirement account that's kicked in after 2 years.
Mm-hmm.
And my financial advisor, who I call Dad, told me that during a recession, I should take all my money out of the sort of domestic equity funds that I have and put them in money market accounts to ride out the recession and then reallocate it after the recession is over.
Okay.
And that in 25 years or so, when I retire, this will make a significant difference in the size of my nest egg.
Okay. Well, Chris, I'm going to guess that you're going to say be yanking all your money out of the market just because it's a little down.
Yes, I am. And for several reasons. One of which is we don't even know if we're in a recession. My guess is that when the National Bureau of Economic Research, when the scholars look back, they'll probably say that we are in a recession right now. Mm-hmm. So there's all this uncertainty that's going on. Here's my problem. Okay, so you get out of the market now. Here's the big question. When do you go back in?
Mm-hmm.
And the other thing to think about it is you're in your early 40s. So your average life expectancy puts you into your early 80s. You're not just investing for your retirement at, say, age 60, but you're really investing over a four-decade period. And I think it's the wrong approach toward managing your retirement money. Sorry, Dad.
Chris, is there any wisdom in moving at least some of your money, perhaps out of the stock market and into a mutual fund or into bonds?
Yeah, I think there are two approaches. Okay, your bottom line approach is you know that over the next four decades, we're going to have these kinds of moves, we're going to have these kinds of swings. So what's the underlying portfolio that you want to create? How much in stocks? How much in bonds? But then you have these sort of big swings in the market and you can see, okay, we're going through a tumultuous time. So you might want to be more conservative. And rather than reinvesting some money back into a mutual fund, you might shift some of that toward cash. So you build up your cash position, which is really what your dad's recommending. What I'm saying is you build up your cash position on a relative basis. So let's say you were 10% cash, you become 15% cash. And then you take advantage of that later on when it's clear we're recovering. There might be something that you can sort of change your portfolio to take advantage of. So it's these marginal moves rather than a big move. But the real key is to create this core portfolio and use this period of time, since you're new to the fund, as a learning opportunity to figure out, you know, I'm not comfortable being this much in stocks. I need to reduce that a little bit. I could care less. Hey, maybe I could be a little more in stocks because it doesn't matter to me that they went down for a while.
So, Jason, I guess father knows best, but Chris knows best, too.
Yeah, that sounds good to me.
All right. Well, thanks for the call.
Thank you.
Well, sometimes it's kind of hard to tell if the money advice you're getting is on target, whether it's Dad or your financial planner. Do let us help. Visit our website. We're at marketplace.org and click on the Getting Personal link. Or give us a call. We're at 877-275-6669. That's 877-ASK-MONEY. All right, Chris, we got an email from Tom in Milwaukee, Wisconsin, and he says he recently learned that Americans can get a CD, a certificate of deposit, in euros from some American banks, and that they are insured. Now, of course, we've all been talking a lot about how the dollar has been tanking over the last couple of years, and so he's wondering if it would be a better deal to go ahead and get a CD in euros. What do you think?
I don't think it's a bad move. The bank that's sort of on everyone's lips who knows about these Euro CDs is EverBank. It's based in Jacksonville, Florida. And yes, the CDs, you know, under $100,000 are insured by the Federal Deposit Insurance Corporation. So it's one way to speculate on the value of the dollar relative to the euro. Now, remember, you are still doing a speculation. I've talked to a number of foreign currency specialists in the past couple of weeks, and if we were to give a consensus, it's that the dollar is going to improve in 2008 relative to the euro. I don't know if that's true.
Right.
But that is right now the sort of consensus expectation, that the euro is sort of overvalued relative to the dollar. That seems to be the big conversation that's going on. So this is your speculative money. This is your fund money. You want to play a little bit off the differential between the euro and the dollar. It's a perfectly valid way to do it. But there are some other ways to play currencies too, Tess.
Yeah, like an ETF?
There are a number of ETFs out there created out of euros. There are also these exchange-traded funds off the Mexican peso. Mm-hmm. And then there's a number of international mutual funds that will be heavily concentrated in European short-term bonds, long-term bonds, European cash. So that's another way of playing the euro. But those will be a little more volatile.
Well, if you're thinking about investing your money across the pond, give us a call first. Our phone number is 877-275-6669. That's 877-ASK-MONEY. And now we're answering your questions every weekday online at marketplace.org. Just click on the Getting Personal link. And stay tuned for more Getting Personal later in the show. This is Marketplace Money from American Public Media. Sir Edmund Hillary's explanation for climbing Mount Everest? Because it's there. But there are folks who travel to remote places for a reason. One of them being, if global warming continues, those places may not be there. On this week's A Day in the Work Life, we chill out with an Arctic explorer as he trains for his next expedition, a journey to the North Pole, the South Pole, and Everest all in 1 year. He calls it Save the Poles.
The best type of training, besides pulling a sled in the wintertime, is pulling tires. So I'm getting the big truck tire out. Right now I'm just going to be pulling one tire, and this thing, I don't know, probably weighs about 50 pounds.
My name is Eric Larson, and I am a polar explorer. Some of the risks on an expedition are death, getting eaten by a polar bear, getting hypothermia, getting crushed by ice, falling a crevasse, falling off a mountain, getting frost, severe frostbite, losing your fingers, losing your toes. There's all sorts of risks. You have a lot of time for self-reflection when you're skiing or walking or hiking in just white nothingness day after day after day. And so I wondered why don't I just get an office job and just set the thermostat at 72 and never be cold again? I think for me is fairly simple. I love to be outside. I love winter. And I feel like my role is to educate people about how fragile these areas and what they need to do to protect them. Well, my career as a full-time explorer has only really been in the last couple of years. But previous to that, log cabin building, housekeeping, I was a dog musher, I was a substitute teacher, I worked for several years as an environmental educator. A few years ago when I told my sister how much money I made in a year, she said I should go on welfare. But right now, I make almost $30,000 a year from my lectures. And I can make upwards of $1,500 per lecture. If I was Neil Armstrong, I could make $50,000 for a lecture. But I haven't been to the moon. Doing the presentations, I really enjoy it. And the story of an expedition, for the most part, is pretty engaging. So I don't really have to do too many flashy things to get people interested in what I'm talking about. But I also try to motivate people to attempt their own challenges or to overcome any sort of fears that they may be facing in their personal life. Because oftentimes, that's a topic that gets glossed over. Fear, failure, those types of things, we don't want to accept those. But I think they're very real, and in an expedition, you deal with those quite a bit because they're not always successful the first time. Making $30,000 a year really doesn't make me rich, but the nice part is, in being an explorer, is I have all the camping gear that I could possibly ever want, and I judge the quality of my life by how many nights I get to spend in the tent.
A Day in the Work Life was reported by Barbara Jean Myers. Coming up, playing the market can be a thrill ride as long as you don't crash.
We ended the year down 12.3%, and that was mainly due to the fact that we were not in the three hottest sectors for last year.
An investment club in Minnesota tries to rev up its financial engine. You're listening to Marketplace Money from American Public Media. This is Marketplace Money from American Public Media. I'm Tess Vigeland. Back now to our investment club series. This year, we're visiting with a club in Minnesota as they figure out what stocks to buy, sell, and hold throughout the year.
The stock didn't do very well.
What sectors do you buy?
Prices are going to continue to go up.
Join the club.
The members of the Crow River Investment Club in St. Michael, Minnesota are a diverse bunch. There's a landscape designer, a food scientist, an industrial waste consultant, and one of them sells primitive Americana, musket rifles, and the like, to collectors and movie studios. More on that later. In all, Crow River boasts 15 members, with four more on a waiting list. On a recent snowy evening, make that snowy and minus 10 degrees, they crowded into Club Vice President Lynn Ostrom's basement living room. My first meeting with this club happened to be its annual meeting, so there wasn't a lot of debate about stock picks. Most of the discussion revolved around goals for the year. Club President Diane Windingland called the meeting to order.
Welcome to the annual meeting of our Crow River Investment Club.
If you haven't already handed your check-in, you can hand it to Craig.
It costs $299 to join Crow River, plus $30 each month. Pretty standard dues based on the other clubs we visited with. After the group approved a new slate of club officers, outgoing treasurer Craig Block ran through a list of recent investments. Crow River has almost $17,000 in the market, with another $2,200 in cash.
We transferred in $1,000. I purchased 5 shares of Stryker, totaling $360.50. 9 shares of Infosys, totaling $389. Dividends, Stryker, of $7.59. Lowe's of $6.08. And PetSmart of $1.80. Giving us an ending balance of $975.62.
So you heard some of their stock holdings there. PetSmart, Lowe's, and Stryker, which sells surgical equipment. The club has also invested in Walgreens, Wells Fargo, and 3 other companies. Now, one of the main requests we have of clubs we profile on the show is that we want to know everything. The stock picking victories and the mistakes. Crow River was hesitant to share at first because, as Lynn Ostrom admitted, the club's performance took a nasty turn at the end of last year.
We ended the year with a down 12.3%, and that was mainly due to the fact that we were not in the 3 hottest sectors for last year, and we took a tumble with our financials and all of our consumer discretionary that we chose not to sell, and it kind of came back to bite us.
So was where you really took a hit in the last 6 months?
We were running in the mid to upper 20%, 25, 27, 22% year over year, and we were doing great until the last quarter of the year, and it just tanked on us, and we weren't prepared for it, and that was our fault, but we're going to fix that this year.
And the club's come up with several ways to do that. It's created a portfolio management team that will essentially pre-screen stocks for the group. The club also decided it might be time to revisit some of its investing rules, including the rule that it won't buy any companies that have been public for less than 5 years. That's meant that companies like Google were verboten. And there was a lot of emphasis on improving communication within the club. Windingland said that should start with the meetings.
I know one of the things I was looking for was having more people participate in the communication at the meeting. Now, with 15 people, it's not like everyone can talk a long time.
Also, this is Lynn, we have too many activities for everybody to be able to study every stock that we have. But if we can do it more in a group setting, I think that might add to the discussion.
This is Kim. I think that is a very good idea and will help a lot. I believe this coming year we'll see much more interaction, probably even closer to the level where Lynn's at. maybe we'll set that as a goal.
Yes, Lynn is the group's leader in loquaciousness. So the club's got a few things to work on this year, but no matter what's happening with its investments, nobody's going to miss the big club social event in June, hosted by member Carol Ripplinger.
We'll have people arrive about 1 o'clock. They'll get a safety lecture and familiarize themselves with some of the weapons that we're going to shoot. And we'll go out to the range at 2.
Okay, I'm going to stop you there.
That sounds great.
What is a barrel shoot?
Okay, this is Lynn. We did this before. Carol and her husband have a business where they are involved in muzzle loading antique, you know, weaponry. We had what's called a black powder keg party. So we go out to the local gun range and we shoot these muzzle loading black powder guns. And we had a great time, so we're doing it again this year.
Until then, they will only be taking aim at the stock market. We'll check in later in the year to see if they're on target. We've got photos from our visit to Crow River, plus a link to the club's website at marketplace.org.
Marketplace Money is supported by Thrivent Financial for Lutherans, a not-for-profit Fortune 500 company helping members thrive in retirement. You can learn more at thrivent.com/retirement. By Reuters, the world's daily news and information source. Before it's news, it's Reuters. And by saveandinvest.org, helping military service members and families manage their money with confidence by providing unbiased financial information, tools, and more. Online at saveandinvest.org.
This week's Marketplace Money buzzword is brought to you by the letter V and the number 18 billion. V is the proposed stock ticker symbol for Visa. The credit card giant is expected to go public in late March. It'll be the largest American IPO ever, worth more than $18 billion. Va, va, voom! Rival MasterCard went public 2 years ago. Today, its stock is worth five times more. And Visa's initial offering price is expected to vault even higher. If it meets the street's expectations, that V could stand for victory. Unless the market continues to plunge into the void.
We're back again with Getting Personal. And as always, I'm joined by Chris Farrell, our personal finance expert. And Chris, we got an email from Jesse and Ann in Union City, California. And they use tax software every year to prepare their taxes. But filing has become a little more complicated for them. Last year, they bought a house and they had a baby. Congratulations to the two of you.
That's wonderful. Yes.
So after using the computer tax program, it appears that they will not be getting a refund. And they're wondering if, because of that, they should find a tax professional instead.
I have a couple reactions. First of all, the tax software is good. Do you ever use it, Tess?
I use it every year.
Okay. It's good, and it's gotten better every year. And so you've added a house. That's a pretty simple tax deduction. And you've added a baby, as we said, congratulations. And also a baby happens to be a tax credit. So in their circumstances, and for most people, if you're really dealing with a salary, a home, children, and your investments are 401k, 403b, mm-hmm. you know, the tax software is going to answer all your questions. I think that's pretty safe to say. Where it becomes important to turn to, or for many people important for them to turn to an accountant, is once you throw in some self-employment income or a small business into the mix,
right.
you have capital gains and capital losses that you want to be taking. It's very easy to get lost. So the more complicated your finances become, then I think it really does pay to go to an accountant. And there's another reason to turn to an accountant. This is the Chris Farrell reason why I turned to an accountant. Time.
What do you mean?
You know, you still have to spend time to gather all your information and make sure you right. have all your information. But then you know what? I like turning it over to somebody else, do the calculations for me. And in their case, they have a baby. They may be up a lot of nights. It may, okay?
That's last thing they want to do is taxes.
And the last thing you may want to do is sit down at that kitchen table and do your taxes. It's a perfectly legitimate reason to turn your taxes over to a professional and have them do it for you. So time is a good reason. Complication is a good reason. From their email, it looks to me like they probably have gotten a reasonable answer from whatever software they're using.
Well, if filing taxes has become, you know, taxing...
Okay. You get to say that once a tax season, okay?
Thank you. Visit our website. It's marketplace.org and click on the Getting Personal link or give us a call. We're at 877-275-6669. That's 877-ASK-MONEY. And our next caller is Mark from Jimenez Springs, New Mexico. Hi, Mark.
Hi.
What do you do there in New Mexico?
I'm a wildlife biologist.
Oh, so what does that actually mean that you do? Are you out in the wilderness all day?
I am out in the wilderness quite a bit, not so much this time of year. I'm in the office a little more.
Do you work with any specific animals?
I work on a couple of different studies right now, one with coyotes and one with wild turkeys.
I guess those aren't the ones that come to our table at Thanksgiving, huh?
Not unless you're a hunter.
Okay. Well, tell us about your question for Chris today.
Well, my question regards my credit card and my credit score.
Yeah.
I'm 26 years old, and I've had the same credit card since 18, and in order to get a card back then, when I didn't have any credit history, my dad was a co-signer on that, and still is. Is this holding back my potential credit score by not building an independent credit history?
Chris?
My first credit card, my dad was also the co-signer on, and I think you really do want to get a credit card in your own name and just remove your father from the minimal liability that something went wrong, because being a co-signer, he's on the hook.
Mm-hmm.
So are you satisfied with your credit card?
Yeah.
So I just call the company and say, look, I'm satisfied with the credit card, but I want to get my dad off as the co-signer. So they'll have you reapply and they'll issue you a credit card in your own name. And then you and your dad are financially separated, at least in this one way.
Okay.
Chris, does that have any impact on his credit history at all? I mean, having his dad there or not?
Technically, now making a broader point because it's not true in Mark's case, let's say his dad had a bad credit score. It could have an impact on his credit score. So by separating going forward, you're creating your own credit history. What it sounds like in this case, he's got a good credit history. He'll get a new credit card. He will have a good credit history. He'll have a good credit score. So going forward, he has really no issues to be worried about.
Does that answer your question, Mark?
Yeah, it does.
Chris, is there any complication with this at all? Is this going to be pretty easy for him to do?
Oh, it'd be very easy, very straightforward. It's fairly common. And, you know, the bank is going to want to keep him as a customer because he's a good customer. And you might take a slight nick on your credit score just because of the transfer, but it won't have any real implications in terms of your credit worthiness. And then that will disappear fairly quickly.
All right. Well, there you go. Thanks for the call, Mark.
Thank you.
Well, unfortunately, those are all the questions we can take on this week's show. But Chris is now answering your personal finance questions online every weekday. Just visit our website. We're at marketplace.org and click on the Getting Personal link. You can also give us a call at 877-275-6669. That's 877-ASK-MONEY. And Chris, thanks for the great advice as always.
Well, thanks a lot, Tess.
This is Marketplace Money from American Public Media. Did you hear the latest from the housing market? According to the Case-Shiller Index, prices dropped almost 9% in the fourth quarter of last year. And you know, to this day, nobody seems to have a true handle on a solution to the whole mess. The latest suggestion from congressional Democrats is a bill that would change bankruptcy laws and allow judges to cut mortgage interest rates. The White House has said, no way, that is a bailout. So what would work? Well, today we talk with someone who thinks many troubled homeowners could and should face the music. Lou Barnes is a mortgage broker and a columnist. And Lou, give us your take.
A great many of the households facing foreclosure are inherently weak, financially weak, and will tend to defy workouts, no matter how well-intended and no matter how energetic.
Why is that? What's wrong with these households?
The mortgage underwriting standards used for most of these threatened foreclosures and the ones in process are inferior to the underwriting standards of the old minimum, which was the FHA, the Federal Housing Administration, mm-hmm. going all the way back to 1934. And the weakness presents in three places. The first one is the need to prove income, always required in a small down payment FHA loan and increasingly rarely done post-2000. Second weakness is the structure of income. The need to have some kind of income stability that would see you through a tough time. If you're in sales, if you're in intermittent work, you're more vulnerable. And the third piece is you got to have some cash around the house. There's got to be some money in savings, even if it's in retirement accounts. And the nouveau mortgage template often did not require anything at all.
And what you're saying is that all of the efforts out there to try to rescue homeowners who are either in or going into foreclosure, that there is, what, a good percentage of those that simply are not rescuable?
Even if we rewrote the interest rates lower, even if we eliminated the heavy adjustments in the classic subprime suicide loan, the minimum payment required is still beyond the ability of many, if not most, of these households.
So do you think at this point that we should just give up on these folks going into foreclosure?
The foreclosure hotlines and workout efforts will be productive only for those households that were strong households to begin with that have suffered bad luck, a transient health problem, a divorce, a job loss, and a new job found. The households that can't manage the current payment, we make the ultimate problem worse by trying to help those that can't really survive this.
The federal government has talked about and or implemented programs that freeze interest rates, stall the foreclosure process. If those aren't going to solve this current problem, what do you think should be done, if anything?
The foreclosure peak is some 5 or 6 years in the future. We're only 2 years past the market peak at roughly January 2006. The key thing now is to make sure that there's adequate new credit available. The worst of the credit crunch underway is not the foreclosures, but the starvation of new credit for people who would buy these houses out of foreclosure.
So we can let some of these houses, perhaps a good percentage of them, go ahead and go into foreclosure, but then you need that credit to bring a new buyer.
Yes, ma'am.
What do you say to those who think this is a little harsh?
My mother, as a teenage girl, lost her house in Ada, Oklahoma, after Dad died in the middle of the Depression. The terrible shock that lives on from the Depression is that strong households, having made no mistakes in judgment about their resources, were knocked over by an external economic shock. In this one, and I mean no unkindness to the families involved, the temptation of credit that should never have been available has magnified the pain that'll be in the households that lose their houses. With sustainable new credit, many of these households will wind up as homeowners, but the next time, they'll be buying houses that they really can't afford.
Lou Barnes is a mortgage broker in Colorado and also a columnist for the Boulder Daily Camera. Thanks so much for your time today.
Thank you, Tess.
And that's Marketplace Money for this week. Next time, a special program about our link to the Middle East.
In Dubai, I've made more money than I ever have in my entire life. And yet, I've never felt more impoverished.
And how the region is intimately connected to the U.S.
What you hear from a number of the investors in the Middle East is that they think that they're getting good value for their money by buying shares in the U.S. banks.
Marketplace Money is produced by John Haas with Rico Galliano, Janae Darden, James Richter, Michelle Phillippe, and the rest of the Marketplace staff. Our theme was composed by Mark Governor. The executive producer of the program is J.J. Yore. Remember, talk to your own expert before you make any big money decisions. I'm Tess Vigeland. We'll see you next week.
Want to hear something on Marketplace Money again? Help is as near as your home computer. To find audio archives of past programs and information on transcripts, just go to the internet and log on to our website. The information you need when you need it is only a few clicks away. Just point your browser to marketplace.org. Marketplace Money is supported by Thrivent Financial for Lutherans, a not-for-profit Fortune 500 company helping members thrive in retirement. You can learn more at thrivent.com/retirement.
American Public Media.